This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is Jewish Crypsis Wannabe Jews. This is related to the previous two installments about crypto-Jews, but I thought it's different enough to warrant its own title, its own focus. It's really the flip side of conversion. It's converting in the other way. But I want to point out in this installment how it's not symmetric. I can sum it up very quickly by saying, or emphasizing what I've said before, which is that Jews make changes so that they won't be noticed as Jews, not so in order to stop being Jews, really. That's what Jewish Crypsis is in a nutshell. They don't want to be recognized as Jews. Whereas what we're going to talk about this time is these wannabe Jews who are non-Jews. They're not Jews, but they actually do want to change themselves into Jews. It's based on misunderstanding, in part on the part of the non-Jews as to the nature of Jewishness. And it's based on dishonesty on the part of the Jews. That realization that I've mentioned several times before about they have to pretend that Jewishness is about religion and traditions and all of this stuff, these trappings, these cultural things that Jews do. Otherwise, they'll be outed. They'll be recognized for their ethnic chauvinism, their racism. The reality is that these non-Jews who want to be Jews, these wannabe Jews, really can't start being Jews any more than Jews themselves can stop being Jews. What's in the way is this biological essence of people and of Jews in particular. In this case, that's what gets in the way of going in either direction. But it's not entirely about biology. Biology is this sort of necessary ingredient. But I think that this issue here about people who want to be Jews, in their minds, they imagine that they can be Jews, demonstrates the power of the ideological half of identity and what it means to be part of a group. I've talked about that in previous installments about group identity, and identity is a fascinating subject. But anyway, just to move along here, in biology, there's actually a term for people like this, people who imagine that they're Jews, imagine that they're part of the Jewish people, even though they're not, and that is the extended phenotype. In biology, there's a distinction between the genotype, which is the material, the physical material needed to replicate an organism, and the phenotype, which is all of the other stuff around the genotype. It's vehicle. You can think of the genotype as the payload and the phenotype as the vehicle. And in a sense, these people who want to be Jews can serve Jewish interests. But even though they can't be Jews, and the Jews recognize that, there are some Jews who see them as at least being able to serve the interests of Jews. And I talked the last time about two of those Jews who have this at least on the surface, this more inclusivist attitude about what Jewishness is, Michael Freund and Stanley Hordes. And in this installment, I want to talk a little bit more about Stanley Hordes, because I went a little too quickly over the two sides of the Stanley Hordes controversy. Stanley Hordes is the Jewish professor in University of New Mexico that is really one of the key people that's been pushing since the mid-80s this idea of this large community of crypto-Jews in New Mexico and amongst the Hispanos. And there's a favorable way of looking at him, and that was the first article that I linked and talked a little bit about. And there's a skeptical view that thinks that these crypto Jews, these mestizo crypto Jews, aren't really Jews at all. And I want to focus more on that second article that I linked about that from around the year 2000 and dig into that a bit. Now, Stanley Hordes, as I said, him and Michael Freund have this idea that Jewishness is inclusivist or can be more inclusivist. But the reality is that most Jews are exclusivist, and Jewishness itself is exclusionary and exclusivist. There's the stereotypical Jewish mother who annoys her kids by constantly telling them that they should find a nice Jew to marry. And there's the Jewish taboo against intermarriage, which is their euphemism for miscegenation, race mixing, essentially, marrying non-Jews. And Jews dislike and disdain even fully biological Jews who convert, quote-unquote convert, or in some other way stray away from having a complete in-group loyalty, demonstrating that by doing what the other core Jews do, celebrating the holidays and the heroes and the stories that they tell themselves about what it means to be a Jew. If you convert away from that, they see that as being disloyal. It's not that you stop being a Jew. In fact, that's the one thing that Jews can agree on about a Jew, is it doesn't really matter what a Jew says. They don't stop being a Jew. And this is a biological Jew. Now we're talking about it reveals really that Jews themselves recognize the biological nature of Jewishness when they describe how even a Jew who converts to some other faith, some other religion, doesn't stop being a Jew because of that. They just stop being a good Jew, really. What we saw with Stanley Hordes, even in the favorable article about him, was the double talk that I pointed out, an example of it, where he was talking about how Jewishness is about heredity. And they realized that with these supposed crypto Jews in New Mexico and in Mexico, that they demonstrate it by talking about who the parents were and who the grandparents were and the ancestors, going tracing all the way back to the Jews who supposedly converted in Spain. And yet at the same time, he denies that it's racial, denies that it has anything to do with genetics, that you can't tell even from looking at the genetics who's a Jew or who isn't. And the second article was titled Mistaken Identity, The Case of New Mexico's, quote, Hidden Jews, unquote. So there's sneer quotes around hidden Jews. And this was published in The Atlantic in December 2000. And I think the title pretty much sums up the attitude of this article. It's a long article, three web pages, and each web page is a full-blown blog-length article, essentially, about that this is a mistake to consider these people Jews, that the ones that Stanley Hordes says are crypto-Jews. And the sneer quotes around hidden Jews is just emphasizing that fact, that it's a mistake. No doubt Hordes wants there to be crypto-Jews and wants these crypto-Jews in particular to be Jews. And if Jewishness was really about religion, then they would be Jews because they put on all the trappings and they say all the right things and they, you know, in all outward appearances, except the biological part, they are Jews. And to a certain extent, Jews are boxed in by this, that they have to, they realize that they're in a conundrum here. They've been telling people that Jewishness is about religion and it's not race. And yet at the same time, they know it is about biology and about who your parents are and so forth. And it's about peoplehood. But it's, so you see this evidence of double talk and double think, around issues like this. It turns out it's, the article, I'm just going to try and sum it up here. I'm not going to read long sections of it. The argument that they make is that Horitz is Ashkenazi, and whereas most of the Jews, the Jewish heritage in Mexico, in the New World, is, at least in the Central and South America, is Sephardic, a different group of Jews. They're related, but they have cultural differences. And using some of those cultural differences and some other hints of fraud that they detected, and it's funny how they sniffed out these things, they determined, at least in this article, and they cite one expert who came to this expert conclusion, that these Hispanos in New Mexico were not actually descendants of Jews. They basically pin a lot of this phenomena on Hordes himself and his leading questions when he asked people about their crypto-Jewish heritage and his presentations on the subject that basically were providing a sort of positive feedback for people to believe that they were. That's the story that they tell, and they give some examples of some of the very tenuous ways that these crypto-Jews in New Mexico felt that they were, that they had some sort of Jewish heritage, and it was almost laughable. Things like Stars of David's on the tombstones, and some of which turned out to be actually Christian in origin. And the fact that their ancestors were merchants, some of them thought, meant that they must be Jewish, or that they were stingy with money, or that they read a lot of books, that these were the kind of things, these were, you know, stereotypical Jewish things that are associated with Jews that made them think that their ancestors, grandparents or so forth, were Jews. The article eventually reveals this other expert, as I mentioned, Judith Newlander, who in 1992, at the height of this hysteria about the crypto Jews in New Mexico, apparently it was from the mid-1980s when Hort started working and got hyped up until 92 or so, and Newlander got into this because she was a folklorist, a sort of a sociologist, anthropologist, I should say, and she wanted to be the first one to do, a true ethnographic research on these crypto Jews. And she says, she admits in the article, that she wanted to be the queen of the crypto Jews. So there was a bit of her own ego in wanting to participate in this, as I'm sure with Hordes as well. The article then gets, this is in the middle of the article, the second page, it gets kind of muddled and starts talking about other Jewish communities in Mexico. And in particular, it mentions Venta Prieta, which is apparently just outside of Mexico City, so not near New Mexico. It almost seems like a deliberate attempt to muddy the water, to cloud the issue. But what it has to say is pretty interesting about the fact that they traced, and it's actually Rafael Patay, who I talked about, it was 8 or 9 months ago now, having to do with Jewish peoplehood and whether the Jews are a race or not. He came up in the discussion. But apparently he had gone down to Venta Prieta to find out what was up there with this crypto-Jewish community there. and in his investigation of it, determined that it was sort of a remnant of a fundamentalist Christian splinter group that's described in the article as crypto-Protestantism, called the Church of God Israelite, that went down there to proselytize and then eventually picked up and left and went elsewhere. And it describes, it goes into even more detail about this, not this particular sect, but this general idea of what it calls Hebraic Protestantism. And it says that the doctrinal roots of the Church of God Seventh Day go back to the Reformation, to an obsession amongst some Protestants with the Second Coming and the Millennium. One scenario, which is repeated these days by many televangelists, has it that Jesus will not return to earth until all the world's Jews are gathered together to welcome him back. If present-day Jews are uninterested in doing so, then perhaps they can be replaced by worthier ones, by Jews who accept Christ as the Messiah. These more promising Jews, in the view of some fundamentalist Protestants, disappeared with the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Now they must be found so that the Savior can return. This logic has engendered a centuries-old preoccupation with identifying certain Gentiles as long-lost Jews. And it goes into quite a few paragraphs describing and elaborating on this idea. But to make a long story short, this is what Newlander believes happened in part. She discovered this work by Raphael Patai, which had been done back in the 40s and 50s. Or in the 1940s, and that's what this article cites as chalks it up as that this was a sort of false group that thought that they were Hebrews because they were actually Christians. And I, you know, the funny thing, they were Christians of a particular sect that was particularly adoring of the Jews, and used a lot of Jewish symbolism and so forth, and really took on board, and this is the point, this is me talking now, and my reaction to this is the crypto-Jewishness of these Protestants. They weren't crypto-Protestant, they were crypto-Jewish, really. They were wannabe Jews. They weren't Mexicans, they were actually Americans that had come south to proselytize, but and they left behind this footprint, these Mexicans that they had convinced to follow their way of thinking. And then over time, like the phone game, the descendants of the descendants sort of lost track of the story and thought that they were Jews, that they were crypto Jews. And so that's in a nutshell what this long article describes in its middle. But then it also gets into Newlander, and she has a more elaborate or a slightly different elaborate theory about these Hispanos in New Mexico. Now, it describes these Hispanos as basically the Mexicans of New Mexico as opposed to the Anglos, the non-Hispanos. And it says that the Hispanos, the article argues that the Hispanos don't see themselves as Mexicans. They're desperate not to be seen as Mexicans. And Newlander actually speculates that the reasons that the Hispanos are inventing what she calls a, quote, imaginary crypto-Jewish identity, unquote, is she thinks they're doing it because, in effect, they're racists, that the colonial Spaniards were obsessed with proving that they had, quote, unquote, pure blood, untainted by that of what they regarded as inferior peoples. She also mentions that this Protestant lost tribes logic is deeply anti-Semitic, that below its Judeophilic veneer lies the belief that because they reject Jesus, most of today's ethnic Jews will in fact go up in flames at the apocalypse. This is something that you can see even with the mainline Protestants in the United States, that the attitude of the Jews towards them, even though they're slavishly dedicated to the best interests of the Jews and defending the Jews and sending their sons off to die in defense of Israel, that the Jews themselves, when they talk about these Christians, sneer. They really dislike these Christians. And this is the way that they rationalize that dislike for them is that they think to themselves, well, these Christians only like us because they want something from us. You know, they put it in terms of themselves, of course, and the way they project their own manipulative, self-centered attitude onto these Christians. Which is not to say there's not some truth to this description of how, what the Protestants think about the Jews. But in general, it comes out, in effect, as a very positive, subservient attitude toward Jews and serving Jewish interests. Back to the this extended phenotype idea, is it really doesn't matter that Zionist Christians are not Jews biologically, if in the end, because of what's it going through their minds, the way they see the world, the way they see themselves, and the way they see Jews, that they can help advance Jewish interests. So I want to talk now in these the last half of this installment about some examples, some individuals that are probably better known, not whole groups of Mexicans that are that think of themselves as a lost tribe of Jews and think of themselves as Jews, but wannabes that are prominent. And here in our own society in America, and the most prominent that probably comes to many people's minds, they're well aware of, especially if they follow celebrity news, is Madonna and her fascination, at least for a little while, with Kabbalah. And I found an article that was talking about this, what it was titled, What Attracted Madonna to Kabbalah, and claimed that Madonna was drawn to Kabbalah while she was pregnant in the mid-1990s. And the group that she formed and joined and then helped fund and grow acknowledges that it wouldn't have taken off with celebrities if she hadn't jumped on the trend. So she wasn't the first to do it, but because she was such a celebrity, other celebrities followed and made Kabbalah into this thing, especially amongst Hollywood celebrities. They want to be Jews. They see all these Jews around them. They want to be part of that, and Kabbalah is a easy way to do it. And in Madonna's case, she actually went beyond just the mysticism of Kabbalah, and according to other articles I ran into, tried to stay kosher and start to, you know, basically follow other Jewish laws. Someone else I had mentioned previously in a previous installment came up in this article about can there be Judaism without belief in God, and it's Robert Putnam, who's fairly well known for writing Bowling Alone, this idea that diversity is, or this non-shocking discovery that diversity is divisive. It's not our greatest strength. It actually causes people to tortoise and withdraw and not trust the people around them. But anyway, he wrote about this idea of Jews without God. He revealed his own thinking about his own Jewishness, and he's a convert. He's a wannabe Jew. He converted 50 years ago, and he says, I'm even more satisfied with the choice now than I was half a century ago, and that's partly because being Jewish is mostly not about beliefs, but about connections with other people, sharing values and a collective destiny. And I cited this when I was discussing the peoplehood issue, the religion versus peoplehood, and it is peoplehood. And even converts ultimately recognize that's part of what attracts them, but it must also be part of what disappoints them when they get there and they convert, quote-unquote convert, and then they realize at some point, especially the ones who try to get deeply into it, that it's about peoplehood. In this case, Putnam puts the best face he can on it. There's no sense of resentment at this from him. Another article that I'll cite is someone I had never heard of before, but I happen to run into this, and it's a recent article from September 12th of this year, so just a few days ago, titled Kol Nidre Helped a Convert Find a Sense of Belonging in the Jewish Community. And it's a biographical article about how this woman, who is a convert, I guess because of her husband, she married a Jew and wanted to convert and be like him, is talking about how wonderful the song is. This Kol Nidre is sung when it's repeated three times. And there's no hint at all in this article that she actually understands the words of the song, what the words mean. She just talks about how wonderful it sounds. And at the end of the paragraph where she talks about the wonderful sound, she says she felt a shiver going up her arms, and she thought to herself, this is what it means to belong to something larger than yourself. I can believe that she felt that, sitting there with all of these Jews, she says, all in a crowd together, wearing their strange shawls. But of course she didn't, as I say, she gave no hint that as to the nature of what it was that she made the shiver go up her arms, that she doesn't recognize that the Kol Nidre is an oath, forsaking all oaths for the next year, swearing not to uphold the oaths, not to be obligated by any obligations that they take on the surface. And the last example I'll cite is Luke Ford. Luke Ford is a fairly well-known blogger. He's described sometimes as a Jewish blogger. In fact, one of the articles I'll link here is titled, Luke Ford, Most Hated Jewish Blogger Interviews Me. He's a convert, of course. He's a wannabe Jew. He lives in L.A., or did for a long time. He used to, back at the time of this, well, actually it was before this article, back around 2000, he was well known for blogging about Hollywood and Jewish influence in Hollywood and porn, the porn industry, which is a misnomer, but that's what everybody calls it, the porn industry, as if there's any industry going on. He would write about that. He sort of he was called the Matt Drudge of the porn industry, according to this one article. And he also tried to be an Orthodox Jew. He still to this day is trying to do it. Another article about Luke Ford is titled, Is Luke Ford Good for the Jews? Out of the Jewish Journal from back in 2007, back when he was still doing his blogging about porn. It calls him a contentious figure in the Jewish community. And this is related to, you know, what I've described is the Jews themselves realize that these converts, these wannabe Jews, aren't really Jews, that there's something unkosher about them. And they do their best to keep them out. And then even when they elbow their way in, like Luke Ford has, they don't like it. They resent it. I'll link a few other articles about Luke Ford. They're pretty revealing. He seems to understand. He's one of these guys who did get into it deeply enough. He understands that Jewishness is tribal and racial. In his most recent blog post, he actually refers to that. It's refreshing to see somebody who's honest about that. In conclusion here, I just want to say group identity comes naturally to humans. There's a natural attraction to it. Because as Ford notes about it, there's a sense of structure. It gives your life a sense of structure and meaning. It's something larger than yourself, as that woman convert notes. And materially and pragmatically, it represents help in the form of allies, other people that will help you. Some people see advantages to the collectivism in Jews, and they're attracted to it, hoping to participate. The Jews don't want them.